The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm excited to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Rebecca Roanhorse. Referred to by the New York Times as one of the indigenous novelists reshaping North American science fiction, horror, and fantasy, Rebecca Roanhorse is the best-selling author of the fantasy books Storm of Locusts, Trail of Lightning, and Race to the Sun. Inspired by pre-Columbian American cultures, her fantasy novel, Black Sun, was nominated for the 2021 Locus Award, the 2021 Nebula Award, and the 2021 Hugo Award. Her other work includes the Star Wars novel Resistance Reborn, contributions to Marvel Comics, and numerous short stories that have won Nebula, Hugo, and Locus Awards. She joins us tonight with her latest book, Fevered Star, a sequel to Black Sun in the Between Earth and Sky series. It continues the story and world building inspired by the civilizations of the pre-Columbian Americas. It's a tale of prophecy, gods, political intrigue, and destiny, populated also by all too recognizable human beings just like us, full of fear, hope, and desire. One review calls it an amazingly complex world, and that it's full of exquisite details and characters that will have readers anticipating the next book as soon as they turn the last page. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here, and I will see you in a little bit for some Q&A.
Okay, thank you. That was a great introduction. Hi, everyone. I'm Rebecca Roanhorse, and I am flying solo tonight. Normally, I do these things with a moderator or a sort of a companion conversationalist. But that didn't happen for various reasons. So you've just got me to entertain you for the next hour. So I'm going to do my best. I do encourage everyone to put questions in the Q&A. Sort of the sooner we get questions, the sooner I can stop babbling and we can answer the questions that you want to have answers for. But until then, I'm going to talk. And the first thing I'm going to do actually is read to you. I'm going to read actually from Black Sun. I'm also going to read from Fevered Star, the second book, but I'm going to start with Black Sun. For those of you who haven't read it, you're just going to have to hear some spoilers by the time we get to Fevered Star. Hopefully you have read it. And if you have read it, then hopefully you'll just enjoy my reading. Okay. I'm going to start at chapter 3. Narampa was not dead, even though the witch Zetea thought her so. She could not move her limbs or open her eyes, and her breath came out in an almost imperceptible wheeze. But she could hear, and more so feel, everything that was happening to her. She felt the apprentices' hands, two girls who strained and heaved as they dragged her from the river. She heard Zetea order them to build up the fire, and then she breathed in the smoke the witch fanned with from the flames. She screamed without sound as the hot, thick drip of blood against her naked chest, and then as Atea's command to her apprentices to spread the blood evenly over Narampai's supine form. And as the witch covered her with a blanket, pausing only to pry her mouth open and place a salt rock under her tongue, Narampa wept unnoticed tears. Narampa had been a child once, long before she joined the priesthood, before she learned to read the course of the sun and command sky made queens. She had been a beggar in the poor district of Tova called Coyote's Maw. Often when the streets were quiet, before the evening crowd of gamblers, tourists, and pleasure seekers arrived in the Maw, Narampa had sat on the westernmost ledge of the top level of the district and peered out over the dizzying distance that separated her home from the wealthier neighborhoods. Looking out over the city, she had dreamed of crossing the woven suspension bridges that swayed like spider silk in the gentle canyon breezes and allowed free travel among all the districts but hers, of exploring the wide roads and stately adobe brick homes, some 4 and 5 stories high, not as a servant like her mother, but as someone who belonged there. And brashest of all, she had dreamed of being a scholar in the Celestial Tower in the district of Otsa. She was only 10 then, her destiny far from decided. She had not yet learned she was poor, and people like her only went to the Celestial Tower as servants. Or once that you were poor, people hated you for it, even when you weren't poor anymore. She remembered a summer night she sat with her family around the cooking coals they shared with their neighbors, talking about how she wished to study the stars. In the Sky Maid districts, the scions ate on great communal terraces where kitchens produced food for hundreds. But in the Maw, people kindled small dugout fires in the streets where they roasted ground cornmeal or buried whole ears of corn in hot ash to bake overnight. At her words, her mother had exchanged a mysterious glance with her father, and he had nodded. "It is good fortune that you would talk of studying the stars tonight, Nara," her mother said, her voice high with excitement. "I spoke to the matron I serve, and she remembered you and how smart you are and how well you learn, and she has agreed to sponsor you at the Celestial Tower." Narampa felt dizzy. "I'm going to be a scholar priest." She knew there were other disciplines one could learn at the tower: healing, writing and history, even the art of death. But all she had ever wanted was to study the sun and moon and the movement of the stars. Her father laughed. "Oh, no, little one. They would never let you study there. You are to work. You will serve the priest, help cook their meals, wash their vestments, clean their floors." Her stomach dropped in disappointment. But her mother gave her father a long look. "Perhaps you will learn something if you listen closely. A servant can learn a lot through observation if she is quiet." "Then I will be quiet," Narampa vowed solemnly, "and I will learn everything." "That's not fair," her younger brother, Dena Oche, protested. "Why does she get to go and not me?" "Who wants to be a priest when you can be one of the Sky Maid scions?" her other brother, Akel, asked. Narampa bit her lip. Being Sky Maid was exciting. Water Strider was her favorite clan, and its matron was the one her mother served. It ruled the district of Tididi, which was closest to the Maw. She could see the curving edges of its cliffs when she gazed across the narrow canyon that divided them, its great sky blue banners cascading down the sides of adobe buildings between dripping green vines and colorful tendrils of starburst flowers. She could even see trees there, trees. The Maw had no trees. Tididi was a garden of impossible green and growth, with a waterfall that ran right through it like a living street, before tumbling to the river that bisected Toba below. When her mother talked of it, she imagined Tididi was something out of a story, a place she could only hear about, but never touch. But now, "What clan would you be, Akel?" she asked. "Why would anyone want to be anything but Golden Eagle?" Dena Oche interrupted. "Everyone knows they are the most powerful of the four clans." "Not if we go to war," Akel countered. "What is this talk of war?" their father said, rough anger coloring his voice. "Tova does not war. We have been at peace for 300 years, since the priesthood united us." "Akel's the one who wants to go to war. I want to rule." Dena Oche's face was so smug, Narampa could only laugh. "Boys don't rule in Tova," Akel countered. "Besides, all you could ever rule is a sewer pile. I'm going to the war college in Hokaia with the scions while I'll learn to fight." "Enough," their father muttered. "You don't know what you're talking about, either of you. Do I have fools for sons, dreaming of being lords and warriors? You'll be lucky to find work in the mines or in the fields to the east." He snorted. "The war college is not for the likes of you, Akel. If war comes, you will be nothing but fodder, or worse, a sacrifice on a foreign altar where the sun priest has not brought enlightenment. And you, Oche?" He turned his gaze to the younger boy. "Akel's right. The only place you'll ever rule is right here in the Maw, and there's nothing here worth reigning over but trash." "Jema," her mother chided her husband, "they're only children. They're too old for nonsense." He glared at his brood one by one. "Remember well, you're no Sky Maid scions, and you never will be. Get those thoughts out of your head or court misery the rest of your life." Silence fell across the small family in the wake of her father's reprimand. Her mother said nothing, but Naraanpa could see her disapproval clear enough in the set of her jaw, the look in her eye. "When I go to the Celestial Tower in Otsa, I will bring you all to visit me," Naraanpa offered, trying to soothe the mood. "And you can ride an eagle, Oche, and you a winged serpent, Ackle, but not to war, just for fun." "I said enough fool talk," her father grumbled, sounding more tired than angry. "You too, Nara, no more." Her promise to her brothers had not come to fruition, of course. Not only because the riders of the great Sky Maid clan beasts were lords even among the Scions, and specially chosen from their clans to train for years before they were allowed mounts, but also because by the time Naraanpa did leave her home and move to Otsa to become not just a servant, although she had been that, and not just a dedicant, although she was that too, but the Sun Priest, its highest honor. By that time, her older brother was dead, and her younger brother dead in spirit. She was not sure of her parents' final fates, but she assumed them dead too. She had never gone back to find out. Because her father had been right. The truth was that as much as she loved the city did not love her back. It had little use for a Ma beggar girl, some use for a clever servant who caught the attention of the aging and eccentric Sun Priest, more use for an unlikely dedicant who had an uncanny ability to read the stars and outshine her society classmates, and a final and blistering use for an idealistic young Sun Priest who thought she could make a change to her beloved city, but instead only made enemies. Again and again, Tova forced her to earn its regard, and she had done so every time. She comforted herself with the fact that she had not done it for glory or for power, but for the worst reason of all, faith. Faith in the place she called her home. But, she thought, as she lay under the witch's blanket, plagued by memories of her childhood and her foolish fantasies, blood drying on her skin and salt burning her mouth, faith is not going to save me now. And that's The Taste of Black Sun. I hope people are familiar with the series, but I'll do a little, I'm not going to assume, so I'm going to try to fill in some blanks. But for those who maybe are not so familiar, it is a fantasy series, an epic fantasy series inspired by, I'm looking at my notes, so if you see me look down, I'm just looking at notes, inspired by the pre-Columbian Americas. So really the origin of the idea for the story was me being a big nerd. I grew up, reading epic fantasy. I think my first fantasy series was probably like Susan Cooper, The Dark is Rising. I remember Lloyd Alexander's The Black Cauldron. And then I went on to read David Eddings, The Belgariad, and of course the Dragonlance Chronicles. So if you see a little Raistlin and Serapio, you know why, if you're familiar with the Dragonlance Chronicles. Then of course, A Song of Ice and Fire, Robert Jordan, Eye of the World, all of that stuff is really in my imagination, in my sort of creative DNA. And I always wanted to read an epic fantasy set in the Americas, because as most of you probably realize, all the stories I mentioned are set in some version of Europe, a fake Europe, but like a sort of a pseudo Europe, or England or Wales or whatever that is. And I always wonder, well, what about America? Like, we have all these wonderful, rich cultures and history that just seemed ripe for an epic fantasy series. And there might be some out there, but I certainly never read them as a young person. And even now, I haven't really seen it. So I guess, when I had the opportunity to write these books, I guess I sort of did what Toni Morrison calls us to do and write the story that I wanted to read. And so this is really the story that I wanted to read that really plays on a lot of those tropes, those familiar epic fantasy tropes, and either sort of interrogates them, like the character Serapio, I think really interrogates or is meant to interrogate the chosen one trope, the farm boy plucked out of obscurity, to become like the king or the savior or whatever that is. He's sort of a challenge to that concept. But also to sort of engage with a lot of those tropes. So instead of having maybe like dragons We have giant crows, or we have winged serpents, things that are more familiar to the landscape. Because I did try to not just, you know, take all these sort of European concepts and then just plunk them in like, you know, sort of a pre-Columbian fantasy. I wanted things that seemed native to the land or to the cultures of the people. And of course, there's multiple cultures sort of represented in Black Sun, but not historically accurate. This is not a history book. Let me just emphasize that there is magic and there are giant flying crows and all sorts of things. And I took a lot of liberties with historical accuracy. I mixed some cultural concepts with others, but certainly of the four main city-states that exist in this world, which is called the Meridian, and which I actually have a map, so I'll bust out the map. So every fantasy writer's dream is to get a map. Okay. This is like, you know, achievement unlocked. So I didn't just get one map. I got two maps. So pretty snazzy. So this is the map of the Meridian, and you'll sort of notice if you tilt it a certain way that it looks a bit like the Gulf of Mexico. That is not an accident. And so each of these cultures, in the book, represent in certain ways various cultures, real life cultures, but with a heavy dose of like fake, with a heavy dose of fantasy. So while Quecola is inspired by Yucatec Maya culture, and the language is based on sort of Yucatec Maya languages, I did definitely change things, so there's no one-to-one comparisons or things like that. Tova is inspired by the ancestral Puebloans of Chaco Canyon and Mesa Verde, although Tova itself, the city, in my mind represents something a bit more like Machu Picchu. And if you see in my second map, you have the city of Tova, which I absolutely love. And, you know, these maps, people ask me like, well, where did those maps come from? Did you make those maps? I did not make the maps. In fact, my 12-year-old daughter did the first iteration of both maps, which is really impressive. She's like a great artist. I am not. But she drew the maps, and then we gave them to someone at my publisher whose name is credited in the back of Black Sun, but I can't remember off the top of my head, who is a fantasy cartographer. And that is an actual job. There are people who create fantasy maps for a living. And like, what an awesome job that is. So he created these maps, and I absolutely love what he did. I thought they were really great. Although people have pointed out to me, well, not to me, but have pointed out on the internet that the maps, that some of the rivers flow backwards. And listen, my 12-year-old daughter made these. So fair enough. Nobody caught it, right? But of course, the internet did. So bless those people and their attention to detail. So that is sort of the world of the Meridian, where the story takes place. And I'm going to check my notes to see what I was going to talk about. Oh, yes. So the story, both in Black Sun and then Fevered Star, is told in multiple point of views, which again is something you see in epic fantasy and something I really loved, like getting this chance to write this big, sprawling epic fantasy. Like, I think what makes fantasy epic is scope and scale. You want a big world, you want multiple cultures, you want layers of history that feel heavy and lived in. Like, one of the things I think about when I talk about world building is I love world building that's like an iceberg. And so the story is taking place just on the part above the water. You know, this is what you see, but your story should feel like there's a massive iceberg underneath, that there's layers of history and lore and legend and politics. So I want my world building to be iceberg-esque. And so I want all these sort of layers underneath it. And I was gonna talk about characters and I got distracted. I don't know why I talked about that, but we will talk about characters and maybe I'll come back to it. So these four point of view characters in Black Sun, and then Fevered Star as a fifth point of view character. And there will be a book three. This is a trilogy. Whether or not another point of view character is added, we'll see. I'm very tempted, but I do also hear that it's hard enough to keep up with like five people. So I don't want to like, you know, drive people nuts. So we'll see how that goes. If one is required, then I will add one. But let's go with four or five. You know, they each sort of represented foray into the world of the Meridian. They're each from different cultures, or at least different sides of town, you know, sort of different social stratifications. And they each bring sort of a different point of view to the story. And those four characters are Serapio, who is our, I mentioned before, sort of our chosen one, or a very troubling version of a chosen one. A boy who, and I'm going to spoil Black Sun probably for folks. So if you haven't read it, I apologize. I will try not to spoil Fevered Star too much, because I'm sure a lot of people haven't quite read that one yet. But Serapio, of course, is a boy who was marked by his mother to be an instrument of vengeance for her people, the Carrion Crow clan. And so the Carrion Crow clan is one of four clans in the city of Tova, and they experienced sort of a genocide, certainly an effort to wipe them out by sort of the ruling class called the Watchers. And part of the impetus for that genocide was their religious worship. They did not approve of the god that they worshiped, who was this crow god. So Serapio has been sort of raised to become a weapon. He believes he is possessed of the crow god and can, you know, carry out this sort of vengeance. And I think part of the book, part of Black Sun, is really asking that question. Is he truly, you know, a god, or is he simply a delusional man who's very dangerous, right? Both are pretty dangerous. And so that's sort of Serapio's story. Shiala is the sea captain from a people called the Teak, who are sort of a siren, mermaid, all female society, island culture. She is hired to sail him to Tova. And they end up having a relationship, sort of a deep friendship under stress, with a lot in common, because they're both sort of outcasts. Shiala has been banished from her culture for reasons unknown until we get to Fevered Star. And so they bond. And Shiala is really Serapio's touchstone for his humanity, that tries to keep him sort of in this world when he would easily slip into something quite inhuman without her. And so what happens, of course, in Fevered Star, you can imagine. Well, if you've read it, if you're not, they are separated. I'll just get that out of the way. And so they both suffer sort of the consequences of that separation, the emotional consequences of that separation. And then, of course, there's Narampa, who I mentioned, who's chapter three I read, and she's from the wrong side of the tracks. And she has come to power, but is never quite accepted. And she's sort of my, I guess, my girl who like loves an institution that does not love her back. And I think, you know, especially as a woman of color, that should ring very familiar. I went to Yale as an undergrad from like a small, well, not a small, from Texas. Fort Worth is not a small town. I went to a big public school. You know, I was the first one, I think, in my high school to ever even go to the Ivy League. Most people didn't even leave Texas at that time. So it was like a whole new world. And, you know, it's very seductive, you know, it's very sort of exciting. And I have quite fond feelings, you know, from my undergraduate institution. But certainly, you know, and I also went to law school later on in life. And so I practiced law before I became an author. And those are all sort of examples of being parts of institutions that I would love to love, or would love to love me, right? But as Tressie McMillan Cotton says, the institution can never love you. It will never love you back. So really that's Narampa for me. And then there is Akoa, who is a son of privilege, who is trying to do the right thing. He's part of Carrion Crow clan in Tova. The only problem is he doesn't know what the right thing is. And he's sort of torn up inside about concept of duty and faith and obligation and what they all mean. Those are sort of your people. I don't know, your point of views into this world. And then in Fevered Star, I add Balaam. And I'm not going to say much about him. I'm going to let you read that if you have not read it. But he is a Jaguar Lord of Coca-Cola, and he's a pretty interesting guy. He's a little more of a puppet master. He's got his hands in a lot of pies. And it looks like we're at 5:28. So I'm going to actually read a little passage from Fevered Star. If you have not finished Black Sun, you might not want to listen to this, but it's really early in the book. So I think hopefully it'll be okay. And it's just 2 pages. Within even the smallest act of love lies the potential for a miracle, the Obregi Book of Flowers. The Ojo Sado dreamed, and in his dreams, he was Legion. He was black-winged murder flying over a vast sea. He was the bloodthirsty havoc of beak and talon. He was the stately flock that wheeled over a city stained by injustice. He became the shout of 1,000 prayers on 1,000 lips. He became a prophecy of revenge. He became the blossoming shadow that engulfed a sun. He was Crow, who then became the slaughter. Dreams morphed to memory, and memory took on shape and form, and he remembered speaking his true name under the black sun and how it had shattered him. He remembered that he had gone forward with staff, blade, and become the whirlwind. He remembered his hands had grown slick with blood and his ears had filled with the cries of the dying. And standing amid the chaos he had wrought, he had exulted. And then he remembered he had been thwarted. The sun priest, who was his nemesis, her death, his very purpose, was not there. She had been replaced by an imposter, some fool wearing the mask and vestments of priesthood, but lacking the essence of a god. The Ojo Sado had slain the deceiver, his rage so dark that he barely registered the sweep of his knives, separating neck and head. And then the Crow God had fled, and his body had begun to fail, as it was meant to, as was expected. But there was one condition his creators had not foreseen, something his mother had not anticipated, an occurrence for which his tutors had not planned. Serapio had made the small crows his friends. He had loved them and protected them. And in the moment of his death, those friends came to him with monumental love and mutual will and sacrificed themselves so that he might live. The Southern sorcerers should have known the power of a sacrifice given with love, as such a sacrifice from his mother had been what tied the boy to her god so long ago. But perhaps they could not fathom that such small beings as crows were capable of so much love, and that a man whose deeds were as dark as his would deserve it. So that gives you a little taste, I'm sure, if you're like, what happens to Serapio? Well, now you know. Great. And I'm going to take a peek at the Q&A because we are about halfway. So this is from Danton McCandless. Do you think that most hero stories, regardless of cultural reference, are essentially similar stories of triumph of good over evil, adversity, along with the restoration of equilibrium? I ask not to reduce, but to suggest there's something primal across cultures to which all humans can relate. So I think a couple of things. I think that a lot of epic fantasy does deal with good over evil. Think like Lord of the Rings, right? Clearly Sauron's the bad guy and, you know, our heroes are our heroes, right? They're going to save the world. That is not what I'm doing. I very purposefully try not to engage in this good versus evil stuff. And if you are getting good versus evil out of Serapio and Naranpa, then you're doing it wrong. I'm not trying to be gray either. So I think your point about equilibrium is well made. I think particularly what I know of Mesoamerican cultures, we're very much focused on equilibrium. And so, and it seems like for me, in my understanding, a lot of the European myths are, you know, sort of light over dark, you know, we're pushing back the dark and the light and, you know, Lord of the Rings, all that stuff. I am not. I am looking for the equilibrium. The light and the dark must learn, you know, to sort of live together. And so if that's a little spoilery, you know, sorry. But that is very much a more Mesoamerican philosophy, I think. And you know, the interesting thing about heroes, so Stephen Graham Jones, who is an indigenous author of horror, primarily, and just awesome. You should read his books. You should read My Heart is a Chainsaw, and coming out soon, Don't Fear the Reaper, which is a lot of fun. I remember he was quoted in this article once, you know, talking about sort of the indigenous hero, myth or I guess, you know, sort of a experience, journey. That's the word I'm looking for. So, you know, you talk about the typical hero's journey and the hero starts at home and then he kind of spirals out into the world and, you know, he picks up a mentor, a wise mentor, and he has experiences. And then, you know, he sort of saves the world. And once he's sort of grown to manhood, because it's usually a he, right? And, you know, discovered himself, then he comes home triumphant, right? But the indigenous hero story often starts with the protagonist separated from home. They're out here on the edge of the spiral. And so their journey is to travel inward and to try to find, you know, sort of through separation and through genocide and through the broken history of, you know, colonialism back to home, back to who they're supposed to be. And that's their journey. And I did ask Stephen if he really said that. He was like, what? No. So I don't know who actually said it. But I love that concept. I think that's very true. And certainly for my characters, each one of them starts in a place that's sort of separated from home. And then their journey is to find their way back. And only then can they sort of be whole and then return back out into the world to sort of do what they have to do to be the quote unquote heroes of their stories. But certainly, are they good? Are they evil? You know, I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not interested in finding out. What I'm interested in is their humanity, because I think each of us has the potential for good and evil. And sometimes, you know, we are good and sometimes we are not. And the decisions we make sort of, you know, lead us on different paths because of, you know, sort of who we are and in our histories and all of that sort of stuff. And so that's really what I'm trying to explore in my stories, certainly in these and with these characters. So hopefully that sort of answers that question. Okay, so Shana Popovich asked, would you discuss the pre-Columbian myths that inspire Between Earth and Sky series? So, because the series, of course, is called Between Earth and Sky, if I didn't mention that. Okay, so I made up the myths in this book. There's no pre-Columbian myths specifically that inspired anything. What I did do was read a bunch of books. For example, this one, Gift of the Crow. So how did I get the crow mythology? Where did all this Carrion Crow stuff come from? I was living in a house at the time that I was thinking about Black Sun, when I wrote Black Sun, that had a big balcony. We're up on a mountain in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this flock of crows would come and visit me all the time. And all the crow people say, please don't call them a murder, although murder is clearly a more awesome name than flock. But they would come and they would roost in this empty house next door, this abandoned house. And then they would come and they'd fly over my balcony and they'd da, 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 da. So I got really interested in these crows. And I started reading this book, Gift of the Crow. And if you'll notice this, the subheading is How Perception, Emotion, and Thought Allow Smart Birds to Behave Like Humans. So you can imagine this is a fascinating book. So I became fascinated with these crows and I learned all these cool facts. Like, did you know that crows have these amazing memories and they recognize people's faces? Like they've done these experiments, like they had people wear like a Dick Cheney mask and then they went out and harassed the crows and everything. So the crows learned to like, beware Dick Cheney. And what they do is once they realize you're a threat or an enemy, they pass that information around the flock and they pass it to their children and their children's children. And so the crows sort of never forget that you're a bad person. And that fascinated me. And I thought, well, what if there's a whole culture? What if there's a whole people built around this concept of crows as creatures of vengeance with long memories? And that's sort of where my concept of Serapio and the crows came from. And all the sort of, in both books, I have epigraphs that start each chapter with sort of a quotes from different cultures or different books, or there's like a crow cycle, which is like a crow mythology book. So all that's made up. I made that up. So there's nothing specific that I can think of that's like, oh yeah, I was pulling that from that. Although it's possible it leaked in. That happens quite often when you're a writer. You're like, oh, that's a good idea. But I know like specifically for that, I made that up. Let's see. So Tim Barastolowicz. Apologies if I missed your name. Do your characters in Earth and Sky map to specific people from pre-Columbian civilizations mythologies? I sort of answered that, but I'll answer it again. Not one-to-one, and certainly I took liberties. But for example, the cultures of Coca-Cola sort of match to the Yucatec Maya in language and of course like in placement. But I like... For sailing methods, I did some research on like the maritime Maya so that I could get inspiration from their canoe building. And because I wanted to know, you know, did they use rows? Did they use paddles? Did they use sails? And I didn't want to just say, oh, well, here's some European ones. So we'll just stick them in there and just, you know, paint everybody brown. It'll be the same. I wanted to really try to be true to the inspiration. So for things like that, you know, that matches for Hokkaia, that's clearly Cahokia, the great mound city of the Mississippian culture outside of what is now St. Louis. But certainly I had to, you know, take some liberties. But if you want to learn about the actual cultures, please do. That's awesome. And that is why in the back of Black Sun, there is a small, in the acknowledgments, I do devote a paragraph to like the top six or seven books I used for research. I mentioned the crow one. This is also a great one, A Scattering of Jade. And it's stories, poems, and prayers of the Aztecs, which I, and it's, you know, obviously it's in translation, but these are like their own words and like their own sort of sayings and all sorts of interesting things. So that's very cool. And then, like I said, there's others in the back on the Maya, on Cahokia, a number of books on Cahokia, on the ancestral Puebloans and Chaco Canyon, things like that. So hopefully that answers that question. Hi, Donna Long asks, I just learned of your books. What should I read first? Well, Donna, you should read Black Sun. Definitely. And before Fevered Star. I don't think you can really read Fevered Star and enjoy it until you've read Black Sun. It is definitely a book two and a trilogy on purpose. I see people like, it's book two. I'm like, well, yes it is. That's the way trilogies work. And they do not, I don't think, I was not trying to write them to stand alone. I think they go together. And of course, book three will be the accumulation of everything that has happened in books one and two. And it will probably be a chunky boy. It's probably gonna be a pretty long book in epic fantasy tradition. And it should be out next year. I just talked to my editor today and that is the goal. So you won't have to wait hopefully too long before you get book three. And I also have a lot of short stories. You can look on my website, RebeccaRoanhorse.com. You can find, I have six previous novels, including a Star Wars novel, a children's middle grade novel, and two urban fantasy novels, if urban fantasy is a little more your style, set on like a post-apocalyptic Navajo Nation. Let's see. And then I have a comic book series, The Phoenix Song. It's a five-issue series for Marvel. So if you prefer comic books, you can go that direction. Laura Kovacs asks, do you have a favorite character? As you look ahead to your next book, whose story do you most want to continue? And are there any characters you're ready to stop thinking about? They're all my babies, you know, in a certain way. So clearly Black Sun was Serapio's book. This is Serapio on the cover. The cover artist, his name is John Picacio. He's wonderful. He's won tons of awards. He's a Mexican-American artist in San Antonio, Texas. And he tells me, you know, he does the covers and they are soul portraits. That's sort of his take on it. So he's really kept trying to capture the essence of the caricature rather than the literal sort of, this is what they look like. Because yeah, Serapio doesn't, you know, he doesn't look like this. Well, at least not in this book. So this is Serapio's book. This is Narampa's book, clearly. This is her come up. And so this is her sort of bursting, you know, with light, without spoiling too much, she's going to burst, right? And then, as you can guess, probably book three will be Shiala's book. That will be her come up. And so I'm pretty excited about that. And I'm be excited to share the cover when it's time. But they're all special to me in certain ways. I guess Serapio might be my fave. But there are some days when, you know, Shiala is my girl, you know, and I just love her. She's, you know, outspoken. She's a hard drinking, promiscuous, bisexual sailor. Like, who doesn't want to do that, you know? So I don't know. And then, of course, like I mentioned before, Narampa's, you know, she's all my neuroses, you know, in her little self. So they all, you know, vary. And then in, of course, in Fevered Star, I wrote, a Balaam POV, which I mentioned, Lord Balaam, and he is so much fun to write because he is the puppet master and he's got a sort of this dry observational quality, and he's fairly amoral. And so those characters are always, you know, sort of fun to write. The harder ones to write are the ones that are like sort of having moralistic conundrums, right? They always say the villains are easier to write than the heroes. And at least for me, that's why I don't write heroes. That's why I write like anti-heroes and problematic heroes and things like that. I enjoy that. Let's see. Oh, Joni. Joni Brill dash off asks, have you turned in book three? Are you still writing? Joni, I am still writing, but it's coming along, and we are on schedule. I am on deadline. So I don't think that will get pushed. Hopefully I will meet my deadlines. They don't like it when you miss your deadlines. And then there were a few more questions. Let me see. You guys are great with the questions. It's awesome. Cause I was afraid I was going to like be here for an hour just talking to myself. It's very surreal when you do a Zoom because you get no audience, you know, sort of interaction. You're just talking to your laptop and, you know, you get used to it. I've been doing it now for, you know, a couple of years, I guess, but it's never my fave. I love being in a room with people and, you know, we get to exchange energy and they get to ask questions, you know, directly to me. And I can know if my jokes are just falling flat or if they're doing okay. But anyway, so I appreciate the questions. So Demos Repson asks, will the Phoenix series continue? I had the same question about Sixth World, Between Earth and Sky books. And of course, whether you'll write another Star Wars book, whatever you do, don't stop. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. The Phoenix series, as I mentioned, was for Marvel. Their superhero character, Phoenix, Maya Lopez, is her non-hero name. She is actually coming to TV, coming to Disney Plus in December, I believe. And I had the honor of being in the writer's room for that and working on the TV series with a bunch of other very cool native and deaf writers and some other folks. Because she is also deaf. You know, I don't know, the comic book takes place, gosh, years and years and years after what's going to happen in the TV series. Because in the comic book, she takes on the Phoenix powers. And not to get too nerdy on people who are not into the Marvel universe. And so, you know, I'm not sure what they're going to do, if they're going to continue her story. Once the TV show is out, how they're going to, you know, sort of approach all that. But I'm very excited to see the TV show and to see what people think of that and the work that folks did on that. So hopefully that will feed your Phoenix fix. The Sixth World, I never say never, but I will say not right now. There's lots of machinations and things that go on in publishing that readers, you know, bless them, they do not see. That is one that has, you know, sort of fallen prey to that. So we'll see what happens if I come back to that world or not. But, you know, besides maybe that epilogue, I think, you know, book two sort of stands well as an ending. We'll see. I'm sure everybody's like, no. But and then Star Wars, I'd love to write another Star Wars. So I got to write the bridge book between Rise of Skywalker and The Last Jedi, which is sort of a one-off. I mean, you don't have to have seen the movies to appreciate the book, although probably, well, maybe you do have to watch The Last Jedi. It's a Poe book. I got to write about Poe and him sort of grappling with the fallout of his actions. And then, you know, the rebellion trying to get its act together. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. I also wrote a short Darth Maul short story, which was the best. I love Darth Maul. So that was very cool. I love working in the Star Wars universe. They actually allow you to be very creative. And you have a whole sort of team of super nerds behind you to answer any technical questions you might need, like, how am I going to fix this X-Wing, you know, or something? And like, well, and if you can do da da da, and you're like, that's good, because I don't know that. So it'd be cool to work in the Star Wars universe again. Very awesome. Tim Barsoltwich. Looking back on the trail of your work, how do you see the books complementing and contrasting with one another? Thank you. Gee, I don't know, Tim. I haven't really thought of the body of my work in that way. Although I do, of course, revisit themes constantly, as most authors do. But you know, for each book I write, at the time I'm writing it, it's really capturing sort of what my interests are at that time. And they're sort of focused in me trying to tell the best story that I can with the most interesting characters and sort of with the craft, my craft level as it is at that moment in time. And hopefully it keeps improving. Hopefully I haven't written my best book, you know, 4 years ago or something. Hopefully it's getting better and better. And certainly my interests keep changing, right? So the things that maybe interested me 4 years ago are not the same, or 6 years ago, because it takes about a year and a half for a book to actually come to press from when you finish it, unless you're on the fast track for book three. So don't get confused. You know, I just try to write that. Although I constantly come back to questions of identity and indigeneity, of the individual versus the community, of those sorts of choices, and both the sacrifices and the rewards of that sort of culture. Because those are the things that interest me. And I'm sure there are others. I noticed recently, I was like, oh, wow, I have a book, Black Sun, and then I have a book, Race to the Sun. I didn't mean to do that. I just must have been very sun-centric or something. I didn't know what was going on. But clearly I keep coming back to celestial events, weather. I keep coming back to weather. I'm very interested in weather. And then this fall, I have a novella coming out. I'm just going to like promo that for a second. I have a little tiny ARC, A-R-C, which is your advanced reader copy, which is what they send out to like reviewers and bookstore people and stuff to be like, hey, please buy this book, read it early. Do you like it? Called Tread of Angels, clearly. And this is something completely different. This is a different world, really inspired by a trip to Silverton, Colorado, where one of the great silver mines of like the 1800s existed, except the people, so this is sort of in a pseudo 1800s filled with angels and demons and fallen angels. They don't mine silver in this town. They mine the corpse of a fallen angel for their technology. It's got sort of an advanced sort of steampunk flavored technology. But anyway, so I assume there are questions of identity and culture and all sorts of things in this one too. Actually, there are. I really play with like the trope of the tragic mulatto a little bit. Maybe that answers that question. Oh, there are more. You guys are awesome. Okay, let's see. And I think we're coming to the last 5 minutes. Yes, I'm gonna try. Oh, someone said, oh, thank you, Tim. He said, my humor is landing. Yes. I have to tell you, when I wrote the children's book, so I wrote a middle grade, as I mentioned, The Reach of the Sun for the Rick Riordan imprint. And I wrote it really for my daughter, who's now 14, but I guess was probably like 11 at the time, for her little cousins and everything, because I wanted them to, my husband is Navajo, and I wanted her to have, to be the hero in the story. So it's based on like Navajo traditional stories. And the main character, Nijone, is the hero, right? She gets to be the hero. But anyway, you know, tons of humor. That's the great thing about writing for kids is you get to like put in all your like goofy jokes and stuff. But she would be my humor tester. I would, you know, try it out on her. And if she laughed, then it could stay in the book. And if she was like, that is so bad, Mom, then I would like cut it. Well, not all of them. Some of them I kept because Hot Cheetos are funny. But anyway. So FYI, John Picasso is enthused by your sir. I'm not sure what the sir is. Is that Serapio? Are you using his nickname? That would be cool. Oh, series. Darn. Thought we had a moment, Joni. Series as you are by his art because he includes a slide of your book cover in his guest of honor presentation at World Fantasy in Montreal. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. John is a bud. And it is a very collaborative, working with artists is a lot of fun. I think most writers, it's sort of their dream to see their work take on sort of a physical manifestation, whether that be a comic book, you know, working with a comic book artist and having your story come to life on the page, or working in TV and having your characters and your ideas, you know, acted out by other people. Sort of a dream come true. I think that's why a lot of writers are like, oh, I hope they adapt my, you know, book into film. I mean, yes, of course, you would like, you know, George R. R. Martin money at some point in your life. But let's be honest, that's probably not going to happen to 99.9% of us. But this whole idea, you know, that people share your vision, because so much of it is just in your head. And if you're lucky, like I'm a very visual writer. So I imagine all my scenes, they sort of act out in front of me and I sort of write down, you know, sort of what's happening. And then I nuance it, you know, but it needs edits clearly. But I know, you know, all of my characters, sort of what they look like in my head, what the settings look like. And so to be able to work with someone like John or like Luca Marchesa, I believe was my artist for most of the Phoenix song series, is just incredible. It's just a thrill. And you'll notice I do have some fan art behind me of Serapio. This my finger. Ooh, the one with the man with the crows is some actually fan art. And it's amazing. It's such an honor. Anyone, when people get inspired by your story, it's just, I love it. Very cool. I think we are coming to an end. We have 3 minutes. And I think I have answered every question. Awesome. So Jason, there you are.
Hey, yeah, that was fantastic. I told you many, many great questions would come. Great audience. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us from Santa Fe. So you're a couple hours ahead of us. So we haven't interrupted your dinner yet. So
No.
Thank you again. Everybody at home, thank you for coming. Thank you for the great questions. The new book is called Fevered Star, and we're so lucky to have had you. Ladies and gentlemen, Rebecca Roanhorse, thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.